Listener-driven, never corporate-programmed, this is Independent Radio, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host, IMA, Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we bring you the 27th installment of our series on data, continuing with a more focused look at computer braining. This is more or less the halfway point in the series, which will finish sometime, well into the spring of next year, with a break of about a month around our annual funding drive. That means that, with a barrel full of shows ready for airing, I am staring down the barrel of 30 to 40 of these little introductory greetings. So we'll be getting on with it. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, Data, Part 27.
To solidify it, the designer carefully imitates information necessary to specify all the shapes, colors, and frame are transferred to tape or disk storage and then read onto film by a laser scanning device. Even with a very powerful computer, a week of calculations may produce less than a minute of finished film. The results, however, often create a fantastic, self-contained visual world.
Many of the television commercials that are most successful today are ones that are like the dream. You know, it does communicate to you subliminally. There will soon be a time that one will be able to tell reality from computer simulated picture.
Information about every baby born in North America and Western Europe is stored in a computer. Hospital records of illnesses, operations, and injuries are also computerized or entered in computers. Census records counting a nation's population are computerized. So are income tax returns, bank accounts, bills from stores and utility companies, driving, fishing, and hunting licenses, school records, and airline reservations. The space shuttle and other complex machinery depend on computers in order to function properly. There are computers in schools, offices, factories, and private homes. There are even computers that play electronic games. Computers have become a highly important part of the modern world and are expected to become even more important in the future. The electronic computer has been in existence only a short time, but the idea of a machine to simplify counting is very old. Perhaps the first calculating or counting device was the abacus. The abacus was invented in Asia about 2,000 years ago. It has rows of beads that the user moves by hand to add, subtract, multiply, and divide numbers. Someone who is quite skilled with an abacus can do fast calculations, but it is a simple and relatively limited calculator. The first step toward developing a real computer came in the 17th century when a young Frenchman named Blaise Pascal invented a counting machine. Pascal's machine was run by gears. It could add and subtract and could carry numbers from one column to the next. The next significant advance toward developing computers took place in the 18th century. It was an automatic textile loom invented by another Frenchman, Joseph-Marie Jacquard. Though it wasn't a counting device, it made a great contribution to the field of computers. It used paper cards with information recorded on them by means of a system of holes. To some extent, punch cards can be traced to Jacquard's invention. The 19th century brought more developments. Charles Babbage, an English mathematics professor, drew up plans for a digital computer, and Lady Augusta Lovelace, a talented amateur mathematician, devised a system of binary arithmetic, which is still used for computers. Still later in the 19th century, an American, Dr. Hermann Hollerith, devised an electrically driven computing machine. It was designed to tabulate the results of the United States Census of 1890. Hollerith's machine used punch cards and a binary system of numbers. It did its job extremely well. Even though the U.S. population had grown since the 1880 census, it took only one-third the time to calculate the 1890 census. Computer technology continued to advance slowly. Then, in the 1940s, the first electronic computers were introduced. Leading the way was ENIAC, short for the Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer. It was created by a group of engineers and mathematicians at the University of Pennsylvania. Since its invention, there have been huge advances in computer technology. Many of these were brought about by the demands of the space program. Others stemmed from the invention of miniaturized electronic components. Modern electronic digital computers are made up of units. Each unit does a particular job. The input unit reads information, called data, that is fed into the computer. This data may be a list of names and addresses of people subscribing to a magazine. It may be mathematical calculations. It may be the scholastic records of everyone in your school. In fact, it may be about anything you can imagine. The kind of data put into a computer depends on the needs of the user. For example, a department store feeds data about customer purchases and payments into its computer. Then, decisions can be made about which merchandise to reorder and which customers owe money for something they have purchased. The input unit of a computer also reads instructions. A set of computer instructions is called a program. A program tells a computer how to use the data that is being fed into it. A library program may tell a computer to find the names of all borrowers who have overdue books. The person who devises these instructions is called a programmer. The programmer writes the instructions in special computer language. There are a number of computer languages. Some of these are called BASIC, Fortran, COBOL, and ALGOL. These names are a kind of abbreviation called an acronym. For example, COBOL is an acronym for Common Business-Oriented Language, and Fortran is short for Formula Translation. A computer then translates this language into machine language. Machine language is a binary code or two-digit code. It uses two different number symbols. These symbols are 0 and 1. How many zeros and ones there are, and the order in which they are arranged, determine the letter or number they represent. For example, the symbols 1100, 0001 mean the letter A. The symbols 1100, 0010 mean the letter B, and so on. Each digit is called a bit. A modern high-speed computer often holds many millions of bits. The number code, or collection of bits, is recorded with electronic signals, which the computer counts. The part of the computer that does this counting is called the arithmetic logic unit. The arithmetic logic unit takes data from the storage unit called the memory. Then, as it follows the program, it does the calculations it is instructed to do. When the calculations are completed, the answers are added to the computer's memory. Those answers are now available for future use. The unit that delivers the answers is called the output. It produces information in a number of ways. One kind of output unit is like a high-speed printer. It produces information on paper called printouts. Many banks use computers to keep records of depositors' checking accounts. Statements of these accounts are sent to the depositors at regular intervals. The statements are often in the form of a computer printout. The printout shows the date and amount of every deposit made and every check written against the account. It also shows how much money is left in the account. The output unit of a computer may also deliver its information in the form of magnetic tapes, disks, or as a display on a terminal or television screen, which is called a readout. The output may also tell the answer out loud in electronic sounds that imitate the human voice. There are even some computers that produce spoken answers in a human voice. In order to do this, there first must be a collection of human voice recordings stored in the computer memory, The computer then selects the correct words from these recordings and plays them out loud. All the parts of a computer depend on a key unit called the control. The control unit is like a teacher and a crossing guard combined. The control unit tells the computer which data to use and what to do with it. It also tells the computer how to deliver the answer. Furthermore, the control unit makes sure that operations are carried out smoothly, quickly, and in the right order. Although a computer can perform very complicated operations, each step it takes is really very simple. It does not seem simple for two reasons. The first is that a computer works at a tremendous speed. The second reason is that it can handle more than one operation at a time. Still, a computer is just a machine. It does only what it is programmed to do. Programmers or systems analysts use diagrams called flowcharts to help them write programs that computers can follow. Each program is made up of a series of steps. Each step depends on a yes or no answer to a simple question. If the answer is yes, the computer proceeds to the next step. If the answer is no, the computer must perform whatever operations are necessary to reach a yes answer. Only then can it go on to the next operation. A computer performs its operations in a tiny fraction of a second. Furthermore, since it is a machine without any feelings, it never gets bored. It will do the same operations over and over, millions of times if necessary, and never complain. Moreover, if it is functioning in good order, a computer will never make a mistake. Sometimes a computer does turn out wrong answers, but they are seldom the fault of the machine. Most computer errors are really human errors. The program fed into the computer might be faulty, or the data fed into it might be faulty. Of course, there are occasional breakdowns in the computer itself, such as when a part wears out or breaks, or when there is some disturbance with the machine's power source. In a short time, electronic computers have revolutionized the way we gather information, store it, and use it. In the future, computers will have an even greater influence on our lives, on technology, indeed on virtually every phase of existence. Computers are unquestionably a major technological achievement of the 20th century.
Computer. you buy computers other than
data processing capabilities could provide accurate traffic updates and optimize traffic flow, reducing congestion and improving safety. In addition, machines with true consciousness and emotions could also drive vehicles themselves, providing safer and more reliable transportation for everyone. Number 4, environmental monitoring. Sentient machines could also be used to monitor the environment and gather data about complex ecosystems and natural phenomena. Machines with true consciousness and emotions could provide insights into how climate change is affecting our planet, as well as to help us identify ways to mitigate its impact. These machines could also be used to monitor and protect endangered species, as well as detect and respond to natural disasters in real time. And number 5, the creative arts. Finally, sentient computers could be used to create new forms of art and entertainment. Machines with true consciousness and emotions could produce music, literature, and other forms of creative expression, opening up new possibilities for human creativity and imagination. The potential applications of sentient computing are vast and varied, with enormous potential for positive transformation in many areas of society. While there are also potential risks and challenges associated with this technology, it's clear that sentient computing has the potential to revolutionize how we live, work, and interact with the world around us. Autonomous robots are machines that are able to perform tasks without human intervention or control. These robots are equipped with advanced sensors, algorithms, and artificial intelligence that enable them to perceive their environment, make decisions, and take actions based on their programming. There are many potential applications for autonomous robots across various industries and sectors. Here are a few examples. 1. Manufacturing. Autonomous robots can be used in manufacturing to streamline production processes, increase efficiency, and reduce costs. These robots can perform repetitive and dangerous tasks, such as assembling parts, welding, or painting, with greater speed and precision than human workers. 2. Agriculture. Autonomous robots can also be used in agriculture to perform tasks such as planting, harvesting, and monitoring crops. These robots can operate 24/7, reducing the need for human labor and increasing crop yields. 3. Healthcare. In healthcare, autonomous robots can assist in surgeries, provide patient care, and perform routine tasks such as cleaning and disinfecting hospital rooms. These robots can reduce risk of human error and improve patient outcomes. Stanford University is working on a robot that can start an IV, draw labs, and administer medications. 4, logistics and transportation. Autonomous robots can be used in logistics and transportation to move goods and packages, as well as to manage inventory and track shipments. These robots can operate in hazardous environments, such as oil rigs or mines, without putting human workers at risk. 5. Exploration. Autonomous robots can also be used for space exploration, deep sea exploration, and other environments that are inhospitable or dangerous for humans. These robots can gather data and conduct experiments without putting human lives in danger. While the potential benefits of autonomous robots are significant, there are also potential risks and ethical considerations associated with this technology. For example, there are concerns about the impact of autonomous robots on employment, as well as the potential for robots to cause harm or damage if they malfunction or are misused. Autonomous robots have the potential to revolutionize various industries and sectors, but their development and deployment must be done responsibly and ethically to ensure their safe and effective use. Creating self-aware computers raises ethical questions such as how to treat them with respect and dignity, and ensure they're not used for unethical purposes. This brings to mind the moral quandaries in Ex Machina, where a billionaire creates a humanoid robot and tests her consciousness. It also raises important questions about their rights, responsibilities, and governance, as seen in iRobot. Given the potential implications and ethical considerations around sentient computing, what does the future hold?
I'm somebody who grew up watching, like, TNG, you know. The idea that if something is mechanical, if it's a machine, that it can't possibly be alive, is nonsense, in my book. Like, we are machines. We're biological machines. And, okay, yeah, the things we consider to be machines are built by humans. You know, we pull raw materials out of the earth and we refine them and we turn them into whatever materials we want and construct stuff out of them. Well, essentially the same thing happens with humans. Like, we're machines too. We're just different. And maybe we're constructed. I mean, you could, if you have a belief in a god, you could say we're constructed by that god or something. But maybe if you're atheist, you could say, well, we're constructed by this whole planet. Like,
oh man, we need to ask this.
To understand why we're going there, there's huge commercial pressure to build AIs with greater and greater agency to replace human labor. But we're not ready. We still don't have the scientific answers nor the societal guardrails. We're playing with fire. You'd think with all of the scientific evidence of the kind I'm showing today, we'd have regulation to mitigate those risks. But actually, a sandwich has more regulation than AI. So, we are on a trajectory to build machines that are smarter and smarter. And one day, it's very plausible that they will be smarter than us. And then, they will have their own agency, their own goals, which may not be aligned with ours. What happens to us then? Poof. We are blindly driving into a fog. Despite the warnings of scientists like myself that this trajectory could lead to loss of control, beside me in the car are my children, my grandson, my loved ones. Who is beside you in the car? Who is in your care for the future? Good news is, there is still a bit of time. We still have agency. We can bring light into the haze. I'm not a doomer, I'm a doer. My team and I are working on a technical solution. We call it Scientist AI. It's modeled after a selfless, ideal scientist who's only trying to understand the world without agency. Unlike the current AI systems that are trained to imitate us or please us, which gives rise to these untrustworthy agentic behaviors. So what could we do with this? Well, one important question is we might need agentic AIs in the future. So how could the Scientist AI, which is not agentic, fit the bill? Well, here's the good news. The Scientist AI could be used as a guardrail against the bad actions of an untrusted AI agent. And it works because in order to make predictions that an action could be dangerous, you don't need to be an agent. You just need to make good, trustworthy predictions. In addition, Scientist AI, by nature of how it's designed, could help us accelerate scientific research for the betterment of humanity. We need a lot more of these scientific projects to explore solutions to the AI safety challenges. And we need to do it quickly. Most of the discussions you hear about AI risks are focused on fear. Today, with you, I'm betting on love.
I thank the committee for its continued work in this and related areas, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Gibbs. Our next witness is Dr. Venkata
Subramanian,
and their impact science and just
more caring on the risks and opportunities of AI. I'm a professor of computer science and director of the Center of Tech Responsibility at Brown University. I recently told you that impact to Vaughan University. The design people learn from the data we receive. And that's one sub-area of AI that is dominant right now, fueled by the collection of vast amounts of data, is machine learning. The design of systems that can incorporate historical data into the predictions that we produce. And in some cases, keep adapting as more data appears. Virtually every sector of society is now touched by machine learning. And the most consequential decisions and experiences in our lives are mediated by algorithms. Where we go to school, how we learn, how we get jobs, whether we can buy a house, what kind of loan we get, whether we get credit to start a small business, whether we are surveilled by law enforcement or incarcerated before trial, how long a sentence for a convicted individual is, whether we can get paroled. The list goes on and on. It keeps expanding. With systems like GPT-3, ChatGPT, Bard, and many others that ingest extremely large amounts of data and huge compute power to create the plausibly realistic conversations that have caught our imagination for the past few months. All these systems have something in common. They are algorithms for making algorithms. The distinctive feature of a machine learning system is that the output of the system is itself an algorithm that purports to solve an underlying problem. Whether it's predicting your own worthiness, searching for a field to use, or even having a conversation with a teacher. As a consequence of the above, we don't actually know for sure whether and how these algorithms work and why they produce the output that they do. This might come as a surprise given how much we learn every day about the amazing and miraculous success of AI. Yet, AI systems fail. They fail when the algorithms draw incorrect conclusions. They fail when they make decisions faulty. They fail when the results of one AI system are fed into another or even the same, amplifying errors. They fail when they are so weak that errors are not functioning. The truth is, AI systems are not the AI is technology, like any other piece of technology that has benefited us. Mars claims. AI needs guardrails to protect us from the worst failures while still benefiting from the progress AI makes. What should these guardrails look like? Any automated system will be influenced by our rights, opportunities, and responsibilities. Should be tested if it works. Should not exhibit discriminatory behavior. Be limited and careful in the use of personal information. Transparent and easily understood. And be accompanied by the exploration. Possible, then that's still. And also, just a reminder, care, but this is not, I'm not making a metaphysical point here, so I'm not saying embodiment is a necessary condition for consciousness. That would be an overly metaphysical, metaphilosophical approach to our thing. So I'm actually receptive. In fact, my most recent work has been actually sort of challenging myself on the way we use language and thinking maybe we can vision extending the adaptable object consciousness for the disembodied and body case of large language models. Maybe you have read enough of hacking.
So you would agree that having a body is not necessary for intelligence and consciousness, but when you're being given a body, you should be able to learn how to make use of it.
The framing of your question, again, presupposes that there's a metaphysical fact to the matter. So when you're asking whether I assent to that or not, you're assuming that I've come in from the same position as you, whereby you think that there's a fact of the matter there, and whether you're an essentialist or a functionalist or any kind of ist, all of those ists, often there are facts of the matter there, and that's the kindergarten wouldn't die, that there are facts of the matter either, that I would rather transcend that whole way of thinking. I think we should stop using the smushing words.
So, as I understood, Dmitry, your answer about it actually doesn't matter the sentience of the agent being interacted with as long as the person has the feeling. Matthew, you work with a robotic AI surgeon that assists you, and you implant a machine into minds, actual minds. You have an open skull. You look at the brain. You can't see a mind in there. But, you know, much of this conference so far, I've noticed a distinction between the natural versus the artificial kind. And you are actually there at the interface, stitching them together. Do you see the machine that you're working with as an AI system in the same way that we're having these debates? Is it a full AI system? You're inserting it into a body. So this whole embodied, not embodied kind of becomes moot as you...
Moreover, all these predictions should be documented and reported on clearly for independent scrutiny. Congress should enshrine these ideas in legislation, not just for government use of AI, but for private sector uses of AI that have people facing impact. I'm a computer scientist, a card-carrying computer scientist, I like to say, and my work is to imagine technological futures. There is a future in which automated technology is an assistant. It enables human freedom, liberty, and flourishing. Where the technology we build is inclusive and helps all of us achieve our dreams and maximize our potential. But there's another future in which we are at the mercy of technology, which the world is shaped by algorithms and we are forced to conform, in which those who have access to resources and power control the world and the rest of us are left behind. I know which future I want to imagine and work towards. I believe it is our job to lay down the rules of the road, the guardrails, and the protections so that we can achieve that future. And I know we can do it if we try. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Professor. Our next witness is Dr. Jason Matheny. Dr. Matheny currently serves as president of the RAND Corporation, a nonprofit institution that helps provide research and analysis to solve public policy challenges. Prior to his current role, Dr. Matheny led White House policy on technology and national security at the National Security Council, and the Office of Science and Technology Policy and was the founding director of the Georgetown Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Dr. Matheny was congressionally appointed as a commissioner to the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence. Welcome.
Love of our children can drive us to do remarkable things. Look at me here on this stage. I'm an introvert. Very far from my comfort zone. I'd rather be in my lab with my collaborators working on these scientific challenges. We need your help for this project and to make sure that everyone understands these risks. We can all get engaged to steer our societies in a safe pathway in which the joys and endeavors of our children will be protected.
One by one, because it's a substantial book. You know, it takes 400 pages to do that. A really ancient thing. What you need are regions in the midbrain, which aren't visible in this picture, at the top of the brainstem. Given this big picture disagreement, I think we should not be premising public policy on any single theory in this space. I think that would be a significant mistake, to just bet all of our chips on a single theory in a zone of great uncertainty and disagreement. What we need to look for instead is ways forward despite the disagreement that we have now, that involve taking all of these theories seriously as describing realistic possibilities and then see where that leads. The third theme of the book is that in spite of there being no magic tricks and persistent uncertainty and disagreement, overconfidence about sentience, and particularly about the absence of sentience, is everywhere and is dangerous. When researching the book, I came across some truly shocking examples. Perhaps the most shocking example that I encountered was the fact that until the 1980s, surgery on newborn babies was routinely performed without anesthesia. And the surgeons argued that, well, anesthesia always implies some risk. The risk is greater when it's a newborn baby. And they also doubted that newborn babies feel pain. And when researchers were brave enough to challenge this, to question this, and to study the effects of performing surgery without anesthesia, what they found was massive stress responses in these newborn babies that did lasting developmental damage. And there was a public outcry. Both sides of the Atlantic, there was an outcry when this became public knowledge, and clinical practice was changed. It's a sobering example that illustrates this theme of overconfidence. It also illustrates, though, another theme, which is the value of involving the public in these discussions, because it was not entirely from within medicine that these changes came. Public pressure was absolutely crucial. That public outcry, in this case, drove a very positive change in clinical norms in an area where you might think the public has nothing to contribute, namely anesthesiology. To me, that's a more positive lesson than the case. Along similar lines, this tradition for decades of describing unresponsive brain injury patients as vegetative, when in fact, according to the latest estimates, perhaps 25% of them or more may have continuing experience. This is based on studies where you take a patient who is outwardly unresponsive, and sometimes they put them in an fMRI scanner, or sometimes they do an EEG, which is electrodes on the scalp, and ask them questions or give them instructions. They might say, for example, clench your right fist. And nothing happens when they say this outwardly. You know, they don't clench their fist because they can't. But the EEG picks up electrical activity indicative of trying to follow the command.
The room can thus be conscious and non-conscious at the same time. This perspective transcends conventional assumptions about cognition. If consciousness depends on the observer's vantage point, then sentience is relative, not absolute. The possibilities implied are as vast as the cosmos. Conclusion. Re-examining the Chinese room through the lens of quantum mechanics reveals our limited comprehension of consciousness. There may be modes of sentience entirely alien to human experience. As we build advanced AI systems, we must expand our imagination beyond anthropocentric biases. The interconnected nature of reality suggests networks and relationships, not individual components, engender awareness. In our final episode, we'll dive into how these quantum insights could transform approaches to creating conscious machines.
It works really well for
Welcome to the committee. You may proceed with your opening comments.
Thank you, Chairman Peters and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. For the past 75 years, RAND has conducted nonpartisan policy research, and we currently manage 4 federally funded research and development centers for the federal government, including 1 for the Department of Homeland Security and 3 for the Department of Defense. Today, I'll focus my comments on how AI affects
Picture
national security
and U.S. competitiveness.
Picture a
battered teleprinter from mathematics so tightly that proofs
Among
became
a broad set of
technologies,
AI stands out both for its rate of progress and for its scope of applications. AI holds the potential to broadly transform entire industries, including ones that are critical to our future competitiveness, such as medicine, manufacturing, and energy. Applications of AI also pose grave security challenges for which we're currently unprepared, including the development of novel cyber weapons, large-scale disinformation attacks, and the design of advanced biological weapons. Threats from AI pose special challenges for national security for several reasons. The technologies are driven by commercial entities that are frequently outside our national security frameworks. The technologies are advancing quickly, typically outpacing policies and organizational reforms within government. Assessments of the technologies require expertise that's concentrated in the private sector and that's rarely been used for national security. And the technologies lack conventional intelligence signatures that distinguish benign from malicious use, that differentiate intentional from accidental misuse, or that permit attribution with confidence. By most measures, the United States is currently the global leader in AI. However, this may change as the People's Republic of China seeks to become the world's primary AI innovation center by 2030, an explicit goal of China's AI national strategy. In addition, both China and Russia are pursuing militarized AI technologies, intensifying the challenges that I just outlined. In response, I'll highlight 8 actions that national security organizations, including DHS, could take. First, ensure that DHS cybersecurity strategies and cyber red team activities track developments in AI that are likely to affect cyber defense and cyber offense.
Number 2, electronics. Vacuum tubes and then, of course, transistors could switch millions of times per second. Electricity became a language spoken faster than any neuron. Number 3, war-scale funding. Code breaking, ballistic tables, radar, all of this needed computation faster than human clerks. Governments wrote checks large enough to bend a destiny. Into this perfect storm walked Alan Turing, Claude Shannon, Warren McCullough, Walter Pitts, and an entire generation that believed machinery and logic welded together could birth thought. Spoiler, they were half right, half hilariously naive, and 100% entertaining. But before we meet our first real-life protagonists, let's agree on one ground rule. The road to AI is never a straight line. It zigs into golden ages of optimism, zags into winters of despair, swerves into side quests about chess, language, and cocktail napkin neurons. We're going to trace all of those meanders, and we're going to meet the eccentric characters who powered them.
Literally shove it into it.
No, sir. Not yet, sir.
Not enough stuff.
I think people said when they think about brain implants, when they think about augmenting a brain's capability, as with most technology, the less we know about it, the more we ascribe sort of magical powers to it, or at least overestimate its capabilities. To be very reductive about it, what the current Neuralink device is a Bluetooth mouse implanted in a person's brain. So it's very useful for someone who can't move their body, but it's not extending intelligence in any meaningful way. It isn't. The AI algorithms that say the surgical robot or even the spike detector on chip are using are extremely limited. They're very narrow.
Can you explain how the device is AI powered in any sense?
In the most limited sense, we use AI to detect spikes. We use AI to generate models that translate spiking activity to behavioral outputs. Behavioral output in this case, either say text or movement of robot arm or movement of cursor on screens. And then in terms of the surgical robot itself, we anticipate where the brain is going to be in the next few milliseconds and how that increases or modifies risk of inserting the electrode that the robot currently has peeled off the silicone backing into the brain to avoid blood vessels. And so that extremely narrow, not AI in the sense that we've been talking about the last few days in an interesting way, this very narrow algorithms, fully understandable, not autonomous. In the next few years, you know, this gets much more interesting. That as deployed today, this is very understandable and very unremarkable, very unthinking. It's a tool still.
But it's a tool that is training itself to be you.
It's definitely going to take my job someday, not soon.
And so, one thing, I'd almost like sociologically, I'd like to ask the panel. So humanity has been confronting the difference between natural and artificial kinds for a very long time. Hero of Alexandria, over in Hellenistic Alexandria, wrote about automata, right? He, at the time, had made these doors which would open by weights and pulleys. Prometheus, in the myth of Prometheus, the golden eagle, which comes to peck out his liver, is a automata made of bronze by Hephaestus. Descartes, this is an apocryphal story, but there's a story that's become a fable over time that Descartes built a little automata of his daughter, and he went onto a ship, and the captain was so bothered by the idea of a soulless creature which could move and behave and look like humans that he threw it overboard.
Touring, jogging in a gas mask, Shannon juggling on a unicycle, Rosenblatt soldering perceptrons for the U.S. Navy, and on and on. So if you're ready for broken promises, breathtaking breakthroughs, X on his daily 4-mile training runs, so he wears a military gas mask just in case. Local villagers christen him the Strange Science Man. By war's end, the bombs and their descendants shave months off the Atlantic U-boat campaign. Winston Churchill thanks the cryptologists, but orders their equipment dismantled and burned, and their deeds kept secret for decades. Turing returns to academia with half his triumphs classified and a mind already wandering beyond ciphers to thinking machines.
These kinds of evidence lead researchers to suggest, well, if they can follow commands, that is a marker of there being some persisting experience there that they can't manifest because they are paralyzed. And I see the same pattern of overconfidence in the way that fishes and invertebrates have been neglected in animal welfare laws all around the world, something that I've been trying to change, as I've come on to in the last parts of this talk. And I see it again happening now in the last couple of years in the dismissal I sometimes see of the very idea of sentient AI as being obviously silly. I don't think we're in a position to say such a thing. There's a respectable philosophical view that says, well, why is it that our brain is able to create sentience? Not because of what it's made of, but because of the computations it performs. In philosophy, this view is called computational functionalism. It's been around a long time, it's controversial. But if we think there's a chance of it being correct, we should think there's a chance of AI achieving some kind of sentience in the near future. So we should not be dismissing this idea as a silly one. A fourth key theme is that, well, instead of overconfidence, what we need to do is cultivate a precautionary attitude to all of these cases. We need to err on the side of caution, give the person or the animal or the system the benefit of the doubt. Something that I've been arguing for many years in the animal case. Wrote a paper called Animal Sentience and the Precautionary Principle in 2017 that was explicitly drawing on precautionary ideas in environmental policy, where the precautionary principle is constantly discussed, people point to cases like CFCs, things like that, and say, well, you can't wait for conclusive evidence that something poses a threat to the environment to take some action to regulate it. You need to be willing to take action on the basis of an uncertain evidential picture that nonetheless points towards there being serious risks that you can do something. I argue, well, exactly the same applies in the case of animal sentience. And more recently, I've been turning to neural organoids and arguing much the same applies there, too. In applying a precautionary attitude, I think that what the book is trying to do is help us think through how to do that. And one of the crucial moves that I suggest is pragmatically reconstructing the question. When we ask, is this sentient? In all these cases, what hits us is this vertiginous uncertainty. We don't know, because there's all these theories, we don't know which one is correct. What I argue for is replacing this with a different question. The question, is this a sentience candidate? Where the concept of a sentience candidate is one that I've engineered, so to speak. It's one that I've pragmatically constructed to make the question answerable. I say that a system is a sentience candidate if there's an evidence base that implies a realistic possibility of sentience in that system, that it would be irresponsible to ignore when making policy decisions that would affect them. And, secondly, it's rich enough to allow the identification of welfare risks and the design and assessment of precautions. This turns an unanswerable question into an answerable one. Of course, it does so with some cost. The cost is that the judgment is no longer purely factual anymore. It's no longer a purely scientific judgment. It's a judgment that is, in part, an ethical one. It's a judgment about when does a possibility become irresponsible to ignore. And that judgment about irresponsibility is one about our shared values. So, of course, we can judge whether something is a sentience candidate or not, but only to the extent to which we have shared values that can help us decide when it would be irresponsible to ignore a possibility. So I make that shift knowingly. I argue that this is a pragmatic reconstruction of the question that helps, given that in many of these cases, we can agree on certain key value judgments, despite our disagreement about how likely or unlikely sentience is. And of course, if you're judging something to be a sentience candidate, this has to mean something. It can't just be an empty honorific. You know, congratulations, you're a sentience candidate now. You know, a bit like being a professor. It has to mean something in the real world for policy. And here I advocate a form of